Plenty of seats still up the front, guys. Lots of room up here. Always is. Great. Well, I think we're about ready to start. Welcome to Building Web Applications at Scale with Azure Websites and your final TechEd talk for 2014. Today, we're going to be talking about building big web applications. We're going to be using Azure Websites as our platform of choice, but even if you don't use Azure, if you don't use Azure Websites, I think there'll still be a lot of relevant content in here. We're going to take a really simple sample app, and we're going to grow that app through from a single web VM all the way through to, you know, a big, massive scale level. I'm James. I work for Intrin in Wellington. I'm a solution architect there. I've been building Azure apps for the last four or so years. Before that, I worked for Microsoft as a developer on the Azure team. So what you're going to see today is a whole bunch of really interesting learning moments that I've had over the last 5 or 6 years, and most of them in production. So, two topics for today. We're going to first talk about some of the principles that we need to keep in mind when we're building big applications in Azure. And these principles are going to help us in the second part when we talk about scaling that app. We're going to take it from one web VM, we're going to go to two, we're going to go to many, and then we're going to go to many, many more. So what does it mean to build apps that are big on Azure? What does it mean to build at scale on Azure? And I kind of identified four key concepts that are important to think about when we design and build our apps. And we're going to refer back to these as we go. So the first one's probably of no surprise here, right? Scale was in the title of the session, so you can probably have guessed that scalability is something that we're definitely going to focus on. And the meaning of scalability is the ability for us to add capacity and get additional throughput from that capacity. That's not really a great starting point in Azure, because we pay by the minute, right? So not only do we want to be able to add capacity, but we want to make sure that we make the most of this capacity. Technically, you have a scalable website if you can add an extra virtual machine and support one extra user, but you also have a very expensive website. So we want to be effective and efficient in the way that we scale. And you're going to have to use your imagination here a little bit, because my PowerPoint skills aren't really anything to write home about. But what's important to note here is that when we scale, when we go from, say, one virtual machine to two virtual machines, we should see the same amount of a performance improvement as when we go from 49 to 50 virtual machines. So we want that kind of linear scale model. We can just keep throwing capacity at our web application, and it'll keep increasing the number of requests it can process. Now, that's a really idealized view of the world. Usually, it's a lot harder in real life to go and keep that nice linear trend. And we're going to talk about some of the problems that we're going to encounter through the session today. So the next thing to talk about is availability. So consider the platform we're building on, right? So we're building on a public cloud. It's scalable, it's self-healing, it's dynamic, it's this compute fabric that's constantly changing underneath us. And we're also building these increasingly distributed and composite apps, right? They're hybrid, they've stuff on-premise, there's stuff in the cloud, they're using third-party services, they're using a bunch of Azure services. So we have these increasingly complex apps on this quite complex public cloud offering. So faults are going to happen. Bad things are going to happen every day in your cloud app. So if we want to build in the cloud, we have to make sure that our applications are resilient enough to continue running and continue to provide value when these issues occur. And preferably, a small issue isn't going to cascade through our entire system and take the whole thing down. And, you know, for me, as an on-premise dev, that's my background before going into this cloud stuff, this is a new concept, right? If you tried to open a SQL Server connection on-premise and it didn't work, you would go and yell at the DBA, or you would go and yell at the infrastructure guys. I mean, what? It doesn't open? It's crazy. But in the cloud, we need to be a lot more resilient in the application to these kinds of issues. And we're going to talk a lot about that today. The third thing that we're going to talk about is manageability. And the key behind manageability is that you should be able to manage 1,000 servers just as easily as you manage one server. So as you scale up and as you add capacity to your web application, you don't want to have to hire another operations person every time you do it. So this is really an operational excellence challenge. It's a DevOps challenge just as much as it is an application challenge. We need to be able to detect and resolve issues, push out fixes without big update downtime windows. And a really good example of this is at Stack Exchange, you know, the folks that do Stack Overflow and SuperUser. They talked about their platform a little bit last year, and they said that they will do anywhere up to 5 production releases in a day. So there is no sign of that from my perspective. It's just seamless. It just happens. It gets better. No downtime. But they're able to react to issues really rapidly and push those into production at a low risk. And then finally, last one, feasibility. I guess this is the reality check, right? Building scalable, available, manageable applications is hard. It's expensive. So we can't have everything. We need to make some trade-offs. Either it's going to be on time and on budget, or maybe it's going to be highly available and highly scalable. We're going to have to trade off, and we're going to have to be prudent about the kind of strategies that we employ. So these are the 4 key concepts I'm going to refer back to today as we go into the demos and have a look at our little sample application. And these are the things that we need to keep in mind when we're building big in Azure. So let's go take a look at our simple little starter app. So this is the starter app. This is actually an ASP.NET sample app. It's the Photo Gallery sample app. It's available from the Azure portal if you want to go and deploy it and have a look at it. It's pretty unremarkable. It doesn't do much, but let's take a look at the functionality. We can log in. Maybe. Yeah, there we go. You can register and create a new account if you want, or we can just sign in one I've already created. Cool, and then I can do a simple image upload into the photo gallery. This is the only photo I've got, so you're going to see me upload this photo time and time and time again in this demo, so sorry in advance, it's kind of dull. So once I've uploaded it, I can post a comment on it. I can add tags, I can download full quality versions. That's about it. So you're going to have to use your imagination here, right? You're going to have to pretend for a moment that this is an application that users really want to use and that we're going to need to scale to a high level. So let's take a look at what's required to scale this app. So when we scale apps, we have a really fundamental decision to make. Are we going to scale up or are we going to scale out? And these are both perfectly valid options. So scale up is just throwing hardware at the problem, right? So we're just going to add CPU, add memory, add disk capacity. And this works really nicely for relational databases like SQL Server. They love just throwing this kind of resource to improve performance. And, you know, hardware is cheap. Developers are expensive. It's a good option. And this, in fact, is what Stack Exchange talked about doing. They have a SQL Server backend. They put in just under 0.5 terabyte of RAM, a couple of high-speed SSDs. They load their entire database into memory, and their query times just trend down towards 0. So really good option. No problems with scaling up. The other option is scale out. Scale up, unfortunately, doesn't work particularly well in the cloud. When we're running on a cloud platform or on commodity hardware, it's really hard to go in and call Microsoft and say, you know what, I need faster disks, or I need massive CPU capacity. So instead of scaling up, if we want to increase the amount of capacity that we have to scale out. So we have more nodes in our application. And this has kind of a nice side effect that because it provides a great deal more redundancy, right? So if you only have one machine, then if it fails, then your app's out. If you have 4 and you lose one, then you know what? You've only lost a quarter of your capacity. So that's the pattern that we're going to look at today, scale out. We're going to see how we can scale out each of the tiers of our basic photo gallery app. So as I mentioned, the photo gallery app is available in the website's sample gallery. I took the code, I looked at it, and I thought, you know what, I'll just make 1 or 2 tiny changes. But that kind of snowballed and cascaded, and it turned into a bit of a rewrite. I've kept all the problems, I've kept the UI, but I've made it an MVC, an Entity Framework app, rather than a Web Matrix app. So hopefully it's a little easier for us to follow today. So this is a good example of a stateful application. So it's really hard to scale. So everything runs in the website. So we have the database sitting on disk. It's just SQL Server Compact. We have the session state, if it has any, in memory. We have images actually in the database, which is concerning. It's not ready to scale. It's not scalable. It's not manageable. It's not available. But it's feasible. It's cheap and easy to deploy. So it definitely scores well there. So what do we absolutely fundamentally need to do to this app to be able to scale from one box to two? Now, there's a whole bunch of stuff we need to do this app, and that's what we're going to spend today on. But what is the absolute minimum number of things we need to do to scale this app out? And I would suggest the only absolutely critical thing that you need to do is find a better database hoster. So if you have two web virtual machines and they're trying to access the same file, the same SQL Server Compact file, they're going to get file locking and contention, and that's not going to work very well. So we need to find a proper database. And a great option there is Azure SQL. And certainly there are more recent offerings around the basic, standard, and premium tiers that they've released recently are really, really quite powerful and scalable options. So that, I think, is what we absolutely need to do. But you might be looking at this and you might be thinking, oh, session and photos, you're right. We should do something about that too. But we don't absolutely need to. And let's just have a look at the architecture behind websites to understand why not, because it's actually a little bit different to a lot of other cloud services. So the first interesting point here is that Azure Websites actually has two load balancers. There's the public load balancer, and then they have an internal load balancer that's specific to websites. Now, the interesting thing about this internal load balancer is that it sticks a cookie on the response back to your client, which makes it a sticky load balancer. So if you have a whole bunch of web virtual machines and you have traffic coming in, that sticky load balancer will make sure that your users go back to the same server on each request. So if you do have some in-memory session state, for example, you can actually use that because users will always go to the same machine when they go to your website. The other one that's quite interesting is this file server here. So all of my virtual machines and websites actually share storage. So if I did want to store my files on disk, my photos on disk, that would be fine because all of the websites would be able to see it. And it's persistent storage too. It's not going away anywhere like you might be familiar with other products like Azure Cloud Services. So, well, yes, we could leave our photos there and we could leave session in memory. I don't think that's a really good option. So we're going to move them too. So we're going to move our photos into blob storage. Blob storage is a great option for photos. It's great for binary data. And it also has the ability to serve over HTTP. So when users request photos, they can actually get them straight from blob storage rather than bothering our web server. So that's the first thing we're going to do. The other thing we're going to do is actually move and use Redis cache for session and other general caching. You might be surprised to hear Redis here, but Microsoft now recommends for new development Redis cache over the existing managed cache offerings. And it's really very similar to AppFabric caching in that it's in memory, it's a reliable storage, but it's like AppFabric on steroids. It's more like a database in memory than it is a key value store. So we're going to pick up Redis caching, and that's available on Azure Now in preview. And that's going to be used for session and some other stuff later on. So, in summary, we're going to get rid of that nasty compact edition database. We're going to use a proper SQL Server database in Azure. We're going to stop using a database for storing photos. Instead, we're going to use blob storage. We're going to use caching for our sessions, and we're going to use stateless load balancing instead of stateful load balancing. Right, so we're back here at our fabulous photo gallery website. And before we go any further, let's just check out that little cookie that I mentioned before. So here it is here. It's this AARR affinity cookie. So if you see that in a website response from Azure Websites, it means that you're going to be going to the same virtual machine every time. So let's check out how we can improve this situation. First thing that we're going to do is have a look at how we provision Redis. Now, you have to use the new portal to provision Redis. But once you're there, we have a whole bunch of different options. What did that do? Yeah. The new Azure portal is definitely still in preview. We can come back to that. So once we've provisioned Redis, we can go and use it. And I promise it'll come back at some point. We can go have a look at how to do that. And to do that, I'm going to use the online editor that's available with websites, which is Visual Studio Online Monaco. So this is available. You just have to enable it for your website. It's available through the management portal. And now I can make some live updates on our website rather than having to go through the whole release process. So the first thing, obviously, we need to move to SQL Azure. So update the connection string. No big deal, they're both SQL Server, so pretty straightforward. The next thing that I want to do is add in support for Redis session state. Now, obviously, session state is not something that everyone is particularly in love with, but you know, we know that there are a lot of legacy apps out there that still use session state, so you know, if you do have one of those apps, there's some great options in websites. So I've added in a bit of config that's going to support Redis session state. Now, this is available through NuGet, this particular provider. It's built on Stack Exchange's Redis provider, so it's built on a really rock-solid foundation. And then finally, we're actually going to use Redis for output caching as well. So output caching is like the full page cache, and the app is already configured to use that. And then finally, we're going to get rid of that stateful load balancing. And to do that, we just have to set this custom header. So by setting this custom header, it tells the load balancer, don't do any sticky session management for us. Now, sticky sessions aren't always bad, but in our case, there's really no advantage to having them. So we are going to disable them. So let's see if the Azure portal has come back to life. Yeah, there we go. Eventually it comes to life. So super easy to provision new Redis caches. A whole bunch of different pricing tiers. The key difference being that you can get on the standard tier, you actually get a redundant cache. So if your primary cache node goes down, all of the data in the cache is still available through the secondary node. So if you're storing things like shopping baskets for a retail site in memory, this is a really good option because it provides that additional level of redundancy. And in fact, you can go up to, I think, 53 gigabytes of cache. Obviously, they will charge you for it. That is a rather expensive option, but really easy provision. Click point, and it's ready to use. Fortunately, I've already provisioned our Redis caches in advance, so we're ready to go. So we've made the config changes. We haven't actually had to make any changes to the app code. We've just been able to reconfigure it to use Redis and SQL Azure databases. So let's just tap that, and we're ready to run this new app up. Like all good ASP.NET web apps, it does take a few seconds to get going. There we go. Fantastic. Same photo, same gallery. Let's actually drill into this. And if we take a look at this image, I zoom in for you folks, you'll see it's actually being served from blob storage directly. So that's really good for our web server's performance, right? It's not having to hit the web server every time somebody wants to look at a photo, which is quite often given that it's a photo sharing website. Super. So we've moved to using Redis Cache, we've moved to using Azure SQL Database, we've been moved to using Blob Storage. So they're kind of the really basic things. We're moving some of those things out of the web server and onto specialist platforms. So by fixing those issues with the website, we've been able to move from one virtual machine to two. So that was the first step. The next step, we're going to move from two to a whole bunch of virtual machines. So what kind of things do we need to think about when we take this next step in scale? Well, you might have heard about websites before, and you might have heard that there's this fantastic feature called auto-scale. So you can set up some rules, and Azure will scale your website up and down dynamically depending on load. So it means you can scale when your website becomes popular, and it means you can save money when your website is not popular, probably like this one. However, there's a risk here. If you only think about scaling your web tier, those web VMs, chances are the rest of your application, you know, your database and your cache, may not scale as well. So there's the potential for you to scale out your web front ends and basically just do a denial of service attack on your database. And the kicker in that is that you're going to pay for the privilege, right? You're going to pay for the database, you're going to pay for all of these new web front ends, and you're going to get no performance. So when we think about scaling. Autoscale is certainly a great technology, but we have to make sure that every tier of our application scales well. The next thing to think about when we think about scaling beyond two boxes is how do we optimize our capacity? So rather than getting the web server to do everything, let's use other services that are specifically designed for particular jobs. So CDN is a great example. That's a great option for serving static content, gets it off the web server. Use YouTube to serve video or Azure Media Services to serve video instead of putting it on the web server. Cache, again, a great option. If rather than querying the database every time for the same data, cache is a much better and faster solution. And now we start to get into that kind of availability and manageability space. We need to think about optimizing our actual application. So a few things there that we'll look at the demo around async, logging, and automated stage deployments. And then we also need to think about those faults, those inevitable faults that are going to pop up when it comes to building big web apps in a public cloud environment. So there are two types of faults that I really want to talk to you about, and this is one of the things I hope you'll take away from the talk, this discussion of faults, because this is the one thing that just continually I fail to do with my web apps, and they just continually have these same issues. So this is a critical piece. There are two types of errors, in my mind, that we need to think about when we're building in Azure. The first one is a transient error, and these errors will last, 100 milliseconds to a second. And a really good example of a transient error is that if you're using Azure SQL, sometimes Azure SQL will throttle you. If you're exceeding your capacity, they'll throttle you. It's a multi-tenanted service, you only pay for so much capacity, they'll throttle you. In that case, you don't necessarily have to go throw up a big error message to the user. Generally, if you wait a little bit of time, a few hundred milliseconds or a second, and retry the request, SQL Azure may have the capacity to serve that request at that point. So being able to retry when you see these very brief errors is critical in the cloud. It's going to make sure that those errors don't turn into big, ugly error messages for your customers. The other consideration is around enduring errors or enduring faults. And these are going to last a little bit longer. These could last a few minutes to a few hours. And these are like legitimate outages of services that you depend on. A really great example of this is that there was this quite large-scale application running on Azure. And it was receiving literally thousands of requests per second. And in 0.3% of these requests, they called out to an external service. So very rare. This external service went down. It had an issue, so it was unavailable. So they continued to call it, not knowing it was unavailable. And they called it in a synchronous way with a one-minute timeout. So a request would come in, they would make that call, and that thread would block for a minute as it timed out. Now, you think maybe it's 0.3% of requests, what's the big deal? The problem that they had is that within 3 minutes, their entire site was unavailable. Because every single request thread that they had to process incoming requests was busy waiting to time out against this external service. So even though it was a very rare occurrence, the way that the fault was allowed to kind of cascade through the system resulted in an outage, literally 3 minutes from perfectly working to complete unavailability. So we have to think about how we manage and isolate these faults so they don't kind of spread through our application unnecessarily. So what are we going to do to our simple photo gallery app to enable it to handle these enduring and transient faults and to optimize it a little bit further? So the first thing we're going to do is use CDN. So CDN is an offering via Azure. It allows us to put content in it, and it will distribute it through the entire CDN network. So Azure CDN, I think, has around 29 global nodes. So instead of having all of our content sitting in one blob storage account in one location, it can now be cached in 29 different places around the world. And then it gets that content also off the web server and lets the web server do other things. We're going to optimize the code a little bit around that fault handling. And I apologize for the logo and the image there. I was hoping for like a lens flare for the optimization of the code, but couldn't figure out how to do that. Then we're going to take some of the data out of the database. We're going to put that in the cache. If it's not changing that much, let's just put it in the cache and relieve some of the pressure on the database. So we're going to use CDN, we're going to use caching more, we're going to optimize their website a little bit, and then we're also going to use autoscale, but we're going to use it responsibly. Right. First off, if you haven't used CDN before, it is super easy to provision. You click New, and you select the blob storage account that you want to use with CDN. You can use it with services as well. We're using it with the storage account. So basically, you select the storage account that you want to enable for CDN, and that's about it. Now, any public content in your storage account, so it has to be already publicly available, will be able to be cached and requested through that CDN network. So very easy to enable. You don't even have to give it a name. It just works. So I've already created a couple of CDNs that we're going to use for the purposes of today's demo. So let's jump into the Edge Management Portal. So here's our website. We're going to start off by enabling autoscale. Maybe. We're going to come back and enable autoscale. Oh, no, there we go. Great, excellent. So autoscale is enabled on the web hosting plan. So a web hosting plan allows you to host multiple websites in one kind of logical unit. In this case, our web hosting plan only has our one photo gallery app in it. So let's just wait for this to load up. I really like the new portal, but it is a little bit slow from here in New Zealand. So let's flick into the scale tab, and we can scroll down to the bottom here, and we can set scale by performance. And what's really important here is that I don't just slide this up to 10, because chances are that's just going to kill my database, right? So we want to be responsible. We want to think about testing our app so we know exactly how much capacity our entire app from end to end can handle. And I'm fairly confident that we can scale up to 2 without too many problems. And then we can choose how we determine when to scale, or how Azure determines when to scale. And there are a bunch of different options. So if your website is CPU bound, so if you're actually doing a lot of computationally expensive type things, then CPU could be a really great metric for you to use to determine when to scale. But there are other options as well. For example, the HTTP queue length. So if your application is not actually doing anything, maybe it's just waiting for other users waiting for other systems, then HTTP queue length could be a really good metric to figure out when additional capacity is needed. I'm pretty happy with CPU-based scaling, so I'm just going to click Save, and away we go. So that's now enabled. So if the CPU hits 60% for more than 10 minutes, it's going to scale up and provision me a new instance. Great. Now it's time to jump into the code. Now it's time to actually make some changes to our application. The first thing that we want to talk about is that those transient errors, those transient faults that pop up inevitably in the cloud. And the classic one that I mentioned was really Azure SQL. Sometimes it's going to throttle you. And instead of just falling over, let's actually fix that and make sure that we have a retry strategy in place. And fortunately, Microsoft is going to be able to help us here. Later versions of Entity Framework allow you to set this thing called an execution strategy. They've even built one for you for SQL Azure that knows about the SQL Azure error codes. So you can assign that to your Entity Framework database context configuration. You can say that I want to retry up to 3 times and maybe leave no more than 100 milliseconds in between each retry. So I'm now going to be able to survive those transient SQL issues. And it's not the only one that has that nice retry built-in logic. If we go and have a look at Azure Storage, the SDK provides us with the opportunity to provide a retry client there as well. So we can specify exponential retry, so the wait between each retry becomes slightly longer. In this case, we're going to be having a retry wait of up to 500 milliseconds and potentially up to 3 times it's going to retry. And the timings here and the number of times you retry will be determined by your app. You know, if it's a consumer-facing web app, probably you're going to want to retry quite quickly and then fail, right? Web users don't generally sit there for 8 or 10 seconds waiting for you to get your stuff together, they leave. So if you're going to be able to do it, then do it quickly. If it's a background task, then you may want to look at a slightly different retry policy. And then let's take a look at cache. So this is a simple wrapper function that I've built to access my Redis cache. It tries to retrieve the information from that iDatabase, that's the Redis cache. Then if it does come back with some value, I deserialize it and return it. So how do we work with this in a retryable way? So let's take a look at this. So the first thing we can do is leverage Enterprise Library. They provide a transient fault handling block, and it's really easy to plug into this. You just have to implement this interface, the eye transient error detection strategy. It has literally one method on it, and it determines whether you retry or not. So in this case, it's a really simple strategy. I'm just saying if there was a Redis exception, retry. If it's an out-of-memory exception, I don't want to retry. Things are really bad at that point. So we just retry on specific exceptions. And we could be a little cleverer here. We could say, OK, we're going to retry on Redis exceptions, but we're also going to retry on, you know, Redis exceptions with a specific set of error codes. So we can be really quite detailed about how we retry here. So once we have our error detection policy in place, we'll create a policy. Again, this is part of the enterprise library. You give it the strategy that we've just built, and we've said retry up to 3 times, giving it about 100 milliseconds in between each retry. And then to actually use the retry policy, I'm just going to wrap my Redis cache request with the retry policy. And this was actually quite useful over the last few days because the hotel internet is horrible and it times out a lot. So this was in use pretty regularly. So that handles our transient errors, those errors that we are likely to be able to recover from. What about those longer, more enduring errors? So to think about this, there's a well-known pattern called a circuit breaker. And it works just like the circuit breakers in your electric board, right? If it sees too much going wrong, the circuit breaker flicks and the whole connection is broken. And the circuit breaker that we have here works exactly the same way, right? So most of the time when everything's working well, it's just going to call your function. But when there are exceptions, it's going to keep track of them. And if there are enough exceptions, maybe within a time window, maybe as a proportion of successful requests, it's going to flip the circuit breaker. And when the circuit breaker flicks, then no more requests will be successful. Every single request that gets made through the circuit breaker will simply see an exception, like the circuit breaker open exception. So if you think back to that website where they were calling that service 0.3% of the time, if they'd had something like this, after a few failures, it would have said, nah, stop trying. Stop using all of your resources to do this failed service call. Flip the switch, and everything stops. Now, then the next question is, how do you start again? And the circuit breaker is a little bit clever there. So it's going to wait for a while. It's going to time out and wait for a while. And then it's going to let one request through. It's going to have a lock around it. It's going to let one request through. And if that request succeeds, it'll reopen and allow you to communicate again with the service. If it fails, it's just going to go back and trigger the circuit breaker again. So if we have a look at how we might use this. Cool, I'm going to create an instance of the circuit breaker. So this circuit breaker isn't part of the enterprise library. This is actually based on some sample code that's available on MSDN. If you just search for circuit breaker pattern, you'll find it. My one is a pretty poor implementation, to be honest. I'm sure you can come up with something a little more sophisticated. But again, it's pretty easy to invoke. Okay, so what have we done to this cache request? Obviously, the code is now a lot messier. But if there is a transient issue, we can recover or just retry. If there's an actual service issue, right? Redis cache is actually in preview, so that's a legitimate possibility. We'll stop calling it. We're just going to leave it alone. And we're not going to tie up our web server resources on a failed or lost cause. Now, the last thing we're going to do here is one issue that we have learned from bitter experience, and that's if your cache is unavailable, does that mean your website should go down? Right? You can always go back to SQL, right? A failure in your caching tier shouldn't mean that your entire website is unavailable. Now, you have to use this carefully, right? Because again, if you stop using the cache and just send everyone off to the database, you're just going to slam and destroy your database. So we have to do this carefully. But there are going to be scenarios where a failure in the caching tier shouldn't mean a complete failure of your application. OK, so there are our fixes and our improvements. Let's just quickly build this. And let's actually deploy it as well. So I'm using Git. this functionality that I'm about to show you is available through WebDeploy or FTP or whatever option that you choose to use. But let me push these changes up here. Password correct. Great. Okay, so I'll let that go up and spin up. So what's interesting about where I deployed it is that I've actually deployed it into a staging environment, not straight into production. So if you thought, you know, remember when we were talking about manageability and updating the site without an outage window, this is a really great feature of websites, which allows you to have multiple staging slots under your main website. So there's the website, Photo Gallery Basic, and there's a staging slot underneath. And that staging slot has its own deployment mechanisms, and it has its own URL. So the great thing about this is that I can navigate to this URL, make sure all the functionality is working, and then I can just swap it over to production. So I can go into the staging site. Once I'm happy with it, I can just click swap. And this goes both ways, right? So if you deploy into staging, swap it into production, and then you realize that you've made a horrible error, you can swap it back. So this is heading towards that kind of operational excellence, is how do we release in a way that is safe and reliable and enables us to do it regularly but without impacting our users. So if we go and have a look at this new deployment, you'll see up the top here we've got Photo Gallery Basic dash staging. So we're able to go into the site and see if it's working as we expect it to. And you'll also see, thanks to some of the changes, it's now serving this content from the CDN. And that was super easy, right? We just selected the storage account, click New CDN, update the links in our application, and suddenly we can access all of our public content through the CDN. Cool, so we've just talked about a whole bunch of different technologies that are available on Azure that help us build more scalable and more reliable websites. We talked about CDN and cache and database, autoscale, and we also talked about some of the code changes that are useful when you're running in this potentially faulty cloud, kind of public cloud environment. So where do we go from here? So now we're getting into the really interesting part. There aren't a huge number of websites that are going to be running at the scale level. You know, we're talking about literally thousands of requests, tens of thousands of requests per second. But it's a really interesting discussion, so we're going to do it anyway, and I hope you folks can pick up a few patterns in here that are useful at all levels of scale. So the first thing to know about Azure is that you can break anything. Any technology out there has a limit. Whether it's queues, you know, they will process, a single queue will process anywhere up to about 2,000 messages a second. SQL Premium has limits on every tier. Compute, there are limits on the number of cores that you can assign to a service. The load balancer has connection limits and timeouts. Obviously, your credit card will have a limit at some point. All of these things have limits. And ultimately, this is a good thing. It allows us to design our applications with these in mind. So we know when things are going to fail. And it also means that Microsoft is practicing what they preach, right? So all of their services are designed as scale out, right? They're not going to scale up to infinity and see their prices go up to infinity. Instead, they scale out. There are fixed limits on most of the Azure platform. So how do we get around the scale limit, you know, on these individual components within our application? You know, if we take the example of a queue, maybe we, instead of having one queue, we have two queues and we round robin across those queues. That will double our capacity effectively and the number of messages we can process. That's one option. We could do it as kind of a tier by tier option. The other option is to scale your entire app as a unit. So from the web tier all the way back, we take a copy of it and we redeploy it side by side. So we have a set of scale units that we deploy multiple times. And then once we have multiple copies of our application running, we can use Azure Traffic Manager to direct traffic across these multiple copies. So Traffic Manager is not a load balancer. It's actually a smart DNS service. So when your consumer makes a request, a DNS lookup for the name of your website, depending on the policy that you apply, Traffic Manager will send them to one or more locations. Oh, sorry, one location that is best suited to them. So once we have these multiple deployments of our application, a whole bunch of good things happen, right? So obviously we can scale more, right? So we can get around any of those individual scale issues that we might see at individual components. We can deploy our application closer to our users, so they get a lower latency. And finally, we're going to get higher uptime as well, because occasionally data centers do go dark, right? A while back, there was some nasty weather, and I think it was in Virginia or somewhere in the east of the US, and it took out Amazon's data center, Microsoft's data center. You know, this occasionally happens. So if we're running at scale, if we're running in with all these thousands of users, we need to consider this. We need to consider geo-redundancy as well to provide that higher level of availability. So how do we go about this? How do we talk about scaling our app? Well, website's pretty easy. That's stateless. Cache, okay, we can deploy another cache. Storage, deploy more storage. SQL, some of you were probably thinking this the moment I said deploy your app again side by side. How do you deploy SQL in a scale-out way? Well, relational databases, unfortunately, are not designed for scale-out. They're designed for scale-up, and they do so beautifully. And I don't mean to pick on relational databases. There are a whole bunch of different aspects of your application that might not scale nicely. Maybe you don't have enough licenses, or there are constraints like that that don't allow you to scale every single tier in a uniform way. So if we have this relational database and we need to scale it, what are our options? How do we think about scaling relational databases? Well, the first rule, and this is one of those other things that is important for you guys to take away. It was a bit of a revelation to me moving into the cloud, and I think it's an important one. If it's not relational data, don't use a relational database. Seems kind of obvious, but from my perspective as an on-premise dev, that's where I started. I put everything in SQL, right? It's a reliable local store, so I put in blobs and JSON and XML and static configuration data, all kinds of things that were not relational at all. So if it's not relational data, use another store that scales better. Use Azure Tables, use DocumentDB, use Azure Blob Storage like we're using for the photos. Unfortunately, when we're in the business of building line of business apps, a lot of the data is relational. It's actually really hard to say, you can just put it in table storage. No, you can't. It has to be a database. It has to be a relational database. So the first thing that we start with is looking at how we protect our database. So if we can't scale it nicely, let's just protect it so it doesn't get slammed when we get more traffic. And we start with what's easy, and that's caching, right? We've done this on-premise for years. We can do it in the cloud. If there is common data that we request, stick it in the cache, and then we don't have to slam the database every time we need it. The other consideration is using patterns like CQRS, the Command Query Responsibility Segregation pattern. And there's like a 13-part white paper on MSDN talking about this pattern in real detail, so I'm not going to do it injustice and talk about it in detail here. All I'll say about it is that it suggests that the way that you read your database might not be the greatest way to write to your database. So having that one entity framework model to do everything, yeah, maybe it's really great for writes, but maybe for reads it's not as efficient as we need it to be. So in this case, in terms of the photo gallery, one thing that we can say is, you know what? Actually, uploading and inserting photos doesn't need to be a synchronous operation, right? If it takes 3 or 4 seconds for the photo to appear in the website, you know what? We're okay with that. So we can use a queue to do the inserts as we have capacity. And that's another great takeaway from this session. If you're building in the cloud, use queues if it's not synchronous. Use queues. They will save you so many pain points and provide nice scale boundaries for you to work with. So once we've taken those steps to protect our database, everything comes down, all of the other solutions come down to one trade-off. We're trading off strong consistency for eventual consistency. So if we have one database, it's atomically consistent, it has all those nice ACID characteristics. If we want to scale out, if we want to have multiple databases, for example, in the case of database partitioning, where we might put users 1 to 100 in one database, users 100 to 200 in another database, each of those individual databases are going to be strongly consistent, but the whole data set's going to be eventually consistent. Other options, if you don't want to partition and kind of split up your database into multiple databases, would be to use database offerings that support multi-master replication, like MySQL. So in this case, you have two database servers hosting the same database. Your consumers can come in and read and write on both of those databases, and MySQL just magically synchronizes all of the changes. I don't quite understand how it works, but that's definitely one option to consider here. Another option to consider here is SQL Server. and Azure SQL read-only replicas. So here you have one read-write database and a whole bunch of read-only databases. So, you know, for all the read workloads, they can just hit the read-only replicas, and then you kind of protect your read-write copy for the uploads of photos. Or you can build your own. You can use some kind of application-level synchronization strategy. But they all come down to the same thing. We're going to have to trade off some kind of consistency. There's some kind of deal that we're going to have to make here if we want to scale our relational database. So, probably a good time to mention that when you're at this level of scale, when you're talking about kind of multiple scale units, every solution is different. I'm going to give you one solution that's going to work for us. It's not going to be the right solution for everyone. So this is what we've got at the moment. We've got a website, we've got a cache, we've got blob storage, and a database. That's our photo gallery app. What we're going to do is instead of inserting the photos as soon as you upload them, we're just going to stick the photo in a queue, and we're going to have a background task, a web job, picking those messages up the queue and inserting it into the database. So if the database gets really busy, we can just stop inserting photos. We can kind of use that capacity to support users coming to visit the site instead. So we're trading a little bit of performance for a bit of latency. Then we're going to do it again. We're going to take the entire deployment, copy it, and stick it in another data center. And we're going to use Traffic Manager to route between the two data centers. Easy, right? It seemed easier before I built it last night. A little harder than I thought. So we're going to go to two deployments. We're going to go to asynchronous writes, and we're going to go to two copies of the database. We're going to have a primary and a read-only replica. Easy. Right, for the first step, we're going to have to use the new Azure portal again. So let's see how we go this time. Give that a moment. Give it a moment to load up. Still giving it a moment. Let's skip ahead and have a look at the database. So this is in the old portal, which seems to be working a little bit better for me today. So here's the Photo Gallery Pro database. As you can see, we have a primary node, and that's in West US Data Center, and we have a secondary node in East US Data Center. And this is super simple to set up. It's a little bit on the expensive side. It is on one of the higher premium SKUs of Azure SQL, but it allows us to have a read copy of our data in our East US Data Center. And that's still loading. Super. Oh, damn it. We'll come back to that. Okay, so what have we got? We have next step is to configure Traffic Manager, right? So we have our two deployments, which I was going to show you in the portal, but that's still loading. But I'll show you in the browser instead. Here we go. So if you have a look at this, we're running, there we go, Photo Gallery sample in the West US Data Center. And if we flip to this next tab, we're also running it in the East US data center. So we have a completely redeployed application in each data center. Has this come up yet? So to hook this up, to make sure that we only have one URL for our consumers to remember, we can use Traffic Manager. Let's go have a look at Traffic Manager. Here's Traffic Manager. I've already provisioned one earlier on, called it Photo Gallery Pro. And when we configure a Traffic Manager instance, we just have to choose a policy. So you remember when I was talking about it was a smart DNS, so it gives a different response to different consumers. These are the options. So you can have like a performance-based one, so the consumers will get the data center that is closest to them. You can have a round-robin option, so that'll just be a randomly assigned a data center. Or you can have failover, so that's more of an active-passive scenario. So once we have it configured with a policy, we just have to hook in our endpoints. So hey, this has come up. Let's flip to this one. This one seems to be back in business. Okay, so all I wanted to show you here was that we have those two things. So we have two websites, two caches, two storage accounts. So we've completely redeployed that application in two data centers. And that's still loading. The internet's been a little bit intermittent this year, unfortunately. Let's instead jump into the app. and keep going. Apologies if the demo is making your head spin a little bit. We're just going to have to jump around the browser while it decides how long it's going to take to load. So if you have a look at the URL, now I'm hitting trafficmanager.net. So I might be going to the West US data center. I might be going to the East US data center. It doesn't matter to me as a consumer. All the functionality is there. And then once I click upload, it doesn't immediately upload. What that's done is put the message into a queue, and that queue is something that we're going to process asynchronously. Now, this is one of my favorite features of Azure websites, and it's called Web Jobs. And basically, this is a background processing function that website supports. So I have a background processing function here called upload, and it sits and it listens to the queue. And when it sees a message on the queue, it'll insert it into the database for me. And in fact, it looks like it's already processed my insert. There we go, 54 seconds ago. So we can check this out. There's the message that it received. There's the blob that it found. And it put that into the database. So hopefully, if we then go back to our website, there we go, 2 photos in the system now. So how did this work in behind the scenes? Well, this is where Web Jobs gets really, really cool. So all I need to do is create this public static function in a console app, right? We've all built console apps. That's all you need. That's the only skill you need to build a web job. So you build this console app, you stick in a public static method into the web job, and then we use these attributes to get it to listen to various things. So here I've got a queue trigger. So it's just going to listen to the upload queue, and when it has a message, it's going to pick that message up and process it through my function here. But it gets way cooler than that. Let's just scroll over a little bit. It's better. Okay, so it's going to listen to the queue. It's automatically going to deserialize that JSON message in the queue for me. So I don't have to worry about that. It's going to deserialize it into a CLR type. And then, it gets really awesome here. It's going to go and find a blob for me, like a file. That's the actual photo. It's going to look in the CDN container, and it's going to pick the ID out of this message. So I don't have to go in and query blob storage to find this. It's just going to find it for me, and through the power of these attributes, make it available to my function. So it does all that interaction with queues and blobs pretty seamlessly. And it has lots of different triggers. So you can do blob triggers, you can do service bus clip triggers. There are lots of different triggers that you can use. But it makes it a really simple way to process queued messages in the background. So the app is pretty simple. It adds the primary photo blob, it adds the thumbnails, and then it adds the database entry. It's all happening in the background. We don't have to worry about it slamming the web server's capacity. Yeah, let's take a look at it. Good question. So this is actually just running within your website. So let's have a look in the West US deployment. Let's take a look at the web jobs here. I really liked the loading icon when I first saw it when they launched this portal, but jeepers. So there's lots of ways to write web jobs. You can do it as scripts. You can do it as console apps. Lots of different options. To build that console app, all I needed to do is import the web jobs NuGet package, and it allowed me to use those cool attributes to go and pick up various content when it was inserted into the storage account. It's not what I was really hoping for. Trust me. It's running in Azure websites. So you can publish it. It sits in the same hardware space as your website. So it sits in the background. But because it's an asynchronous process, you can do it so it only polls every 30 seconds, or you can run it continuously. You've got some control over how frequently it's going to execute. There we go. This particular functionality is still in preview. There we go, great. So here's my task. It was just a console app that we've uploaded. It has that public function in it, and it's just sitting there running continuously, processing my queued messages. I've been doing a lot of practice, and I've really been burning through the credits, so hopefully it doesn't flick over to my credit card anytime soon. All right. Yeah. That's a good question. I believe by default it'll actually do a batch request. So rather than doing it one at a time, it'll actually go and grab a whole bunch of them and process them. But I haven't done a lot with web jobs, so that's my understanding is that it will provide that batch request functionality. And there is some configuration that's available through Visual Studio. So for example, here I've said because I want a low latency, I'm actually polling every 5 seconds. By default, it polls every 10 minutes. If it doesn't find any content. Great. So we now have our app. It's in the West US data center. It's in the East US data center. It's asynchronously inserting those photos, so it can do it as capacity allows. We're using CDN. We're using Traffic Manager. We're using cache. All of these things have made a big difference to the scalability, availability, and manageability of our application. So let's just flip back to our slides. Cool, and that brings us to the end of the session. I think if you're going to take away, a few more things actually. Azure Websites is a fantastic platform for running high-scale, high-performance web apps. It has a lot of features compared to cloud services that make it a lot easier to develop on, but don't let that fool you. It's a really high-performance system. However, remember, scalability, availability, manageability, feasibility. You need to remember these four concepts when you're building your apps, and you need to take advantage of all the different services that Azure provides if you're going to scale effectively. And whether you're running at one VM or whether you're running 100 VMs, these same patterns are going to help you scale, become more reliable, and save you some money. So, any questions? Hope that was useful. Hope you're going to take something away from the last session of TechEd. I hope you've enjoyed the week. I'll be up here afterwards if you have... Oh, we do have a question. Great.
Are web jobs available in Azure services or web
roles? Azure web jobs is specific to websites. You can do background queue processing in cloud services, but you don't get quite as nice of an experience. Yeah. Cool. No one else? Great. I'll be up here if you have questions, but thanks for coming.